Well, this is a real opportunity to talk with Seth Shostak, the director of the Center for SETI Research. He's also a noted author, Confessions of an Alien Hunter. That's just one of his books, including also Life in the Universe. Let's come back and take some calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute. Seth, when you're speaking to people, aside from the obvious, they want to know about ET life. What do they want to know from you?
Well,
what comes up the most?
Well, obviously that is the question I get the most. In fact, I usually say, "Have you heard anything?" Which is a bizarre question, because if we had, you know, they would already.
You will tell us, yeah.
They would know that. Well, I don't know. Sometimes they just, you know, personal questions. How'd you get involved and that kind of thing? When did you start? You know, when was your first interest in astronomy or things like that? But for the rest, they're interested in, you know, science questions a lot. Sometimes we don't talk about that at all. We talk about old rock and roll. I mean, it just depends.
Simple. But they love space, don't they?
Most people do. Yeah, well, I don't know that most people do, actually. I'm not sure of that. I seem to recall a survey that NASA did maybe 10 years ago, and they found like 15% of the population found space interesting. The rest were kind of, you know, kind of neutral. Some were actually hostile. They thought it was a waste of money. I've run into that, but not very often.
The sounds that are emitted from the universe, that they're out there, how does that happen? How do they generate? I mean, how do planets and stars generate sound?
Well, there's a difference between sounds and the radio noise that we pick up with our receivers, of
okay.
course. In space, nobody can hear you scream, as the trailer for Alien said. So you don't actually, you know, hear the sun, for example. You don't hear it. Although it does make sound waves, but you'd have to be in the sun to hear those sound waves, so I don't recommend that. But it, you know, just hot gas moving around generates, or even not moving around, generates a certain amount of radio static, okay? So, you know, stars make a little bit of radio noise, not very much. Planets do, because they've got, you know, lightning storms and magnetic fields and things like that. Right, you know very well that if you're driving around with your AM radio on and there's a thunderstorm in the area, you'll hear the crackle.
You'll hear it.
Yeah,
that's
you'll
right.
hear it. So there's that. But the big radio emitters, the natural radio emitters in the cosmos, are actually things like quasars. You know, big black holes that are spewing out hot gas. They tend to make a lot of radio noise. Pulsars, which are dead stars, make a lot of radio noise. And actually, just the gas, the hydrogen gas, is just a very, very thin gas that hangs between all the stars. It fills the universe. That makes radio noise too, believe it or not. It's a very weak transmitter, but there's a lot of it because the universe is big.
Disappointing that the European Space Agency lost its Mars probe, huh?
Yeah, well, that's right. The little Schiaparelli lander there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then they find it the next day, and it's sort of a black splotch.
That's right.
It obviously didn't meet a very gentle end.
Things didn't work out quite well.
Well, the thing is, that thing wasn't going to do a whole lot of science. It was only going to last for, you know, less than a week, probably, because it didn't have rechargeable batteries or anything like that. It was simply to demonstrate that the Europeans were able to get some of their hardware down onto the surface of Mars, because in 2020 they want to send a much bigger thing, a thing the size of roughly a golf cart, down to the surface of Mars using the same technique, and that thing will run around the landscapes of Mars looking for life. You know, NASA doesn't look for life, not yet. It looks for, you know, things that would tell you where to look for life, but it hasn't yet, since 1975, it hasn't sent anything to Mars with a specific purpose of looking for life, and the Europeans are going to try and do that. So this was just a test of the landing procedure, and unfortunately it didn't work very well.
I know where you're going to be this weekend.
Yeah, I may be seeing you, right?
That's right. You're going to be on our panel at AlienCon.
Well, I didn't realize you're on the panel. I should check this out.
I think I'm hosting the panel.
Oh, well, in that case, you will definitely be there.
And I will give you full access to say whatever you want.
Okay. No big white hook?
We'll have no hook for you. Absolutely not. You've been a great guest over the years for this program. You ready for some calls?
I am ready.
Let's start with Cliff in Bristol, Tennessee, to get things started. Cliff, go ahead.
Hey, George.
Hey, Cliff.
Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Just a couple of questions. When you refer to the universe, I mean, we're talking millions and millions of galaxies, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's oh, yes.
More than that.
Okay, are we able to detect anything from those galaxies when we've not even really explored our own? I mean, to the full extent. And number two, I know SETI is caught up in receiving signals from other galaxies or planets or whatever. What about sending out signals to these other?
You're not sending, you're receiving, right?
That's right. That's right. Cliff, we listen. We don't talk, if you will. Well, with the exception of this program, of course.
Yes.
No, but the SETI, you know, our antennas don't even have transmitters. We just listen. Now, there are people who do want to broadcast and who have broadcast. I mean, NASA in 2008 sent a Beatles song to the North Star. It's just a demonstration, really. That's all it was. But, you know, we, in general, don't broadcast because the deal is this. If you broadcast to aliens that are 100 light years away, I mean, even if you knew that there might be somebody there, which you don't, it would take 100 years for the signal to get there and another 100 years for their reply. So 200 years have gone by, and you probably don't care much about what they say at that point. So we listen, because if you listen, you might pick up something that was sent a while ago. So that answers your second question. Sending, by the way, is somewhat controversial. We talked a little bit about Stephen Hawking saying that it might be dangerous. I don't agree with that, but there are people who think it is. But in terms of the other galaxies, yeah, there are a lot of galaxies. In fact, there was a research paper that came out this past week saying that actually the universe has something like 10 times as many galaxies as we thought. I wouldn't worry too much about that because the number of galaxies that we can figure are, you know, accessible to our scopes, the kind of things we could see, there was like 100 billion of them. So maybe that's more like a 1,000 billion of them, which is a trillion. Those are galaxies. Each one of them has 100 billion stars. So you got to kind of multiply those numbers together in your head there, Cliff, to get some idea of how big the visible universe is. It's enormous. Can we learn anything from those other galaxies? You bet. You bet. I used to have a job studying other galaxies, and you can learn quite a bit, but you know, about astronomy.
What have we learned about dark matter, Seth?
Well, we still don't know what it is. And you know, there are various experiments and so forth and so on. I was involved with dark matter when I was a student, actually. We were measuring the spin of galaxies, and we found they all spun too fast, and that was dark matter. But it's just something out there that kind of holds galaxies together, right? It may have caused the galaxies to form in the first place. So it sounds like it's...
But we can't see it.
But we can't see it. That's why it's called dark matter, because it's dark.
But we know it's there.
We know it's there because of the effect it has. I mean, it has gravitational
effect. Can you feel it?
Yeah, you could. I mean, you know, it's not very powerful because gravity is a pretty weak force, right? It takes the whole Earth just to hold you in your chair. That's a pretty weak
force. I wonder if it's like an other dimension or something.
Well, I don't know. One hopes that it's not, because then how are you ever going to find it? But the usual assumption is that dark matter consists of very, you know, some sort of elementary particles that we haven't detected yet, some sort of things, you know, like electrons, the very small particles. And there are experiments, you know, in orbit and elsewhere on the ground to try and detect these particles and then solve the mystery of dark matter. But so far, the mystery is, maybe the butler did it. The mystery has not yet been
solved. What do you think would make this dark matter or invisible to us?
Well, there are plenty of things that are invisible to us. I mean, there are neutrinos, for example. This is another kind of particle. And, you know, I forget the number, how many trillion neutrinos are zipping through your head every second. But, you know, it doesn't bother you much. And yet they're there. They're real. We know about them. We can detect them. But, you know, they're very fast. They're very small. They're very light. And they don't, you know, have a charge. So they don't do much damage to your brain or anything like that. It's just space is filled with these things. They're all over the place, but, you know, you don't see them. So dark matter particles might be in very much the same way, that they're invisible to us. They're very hard to detect, obviously, because we haven't found them yet. But they're holding things together because there's so many of them.
Let's go to Virginia in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, east of the Rockies. Virginia, you're on with us.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was wondering about something. Ever since I was a little tyke, I asked my parents, how come there's never a Channel 1 on TV, on VHF frequencies? And they told me that it propagated too much. If we transmit on Channel 1 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, it'll interfere with a transmitter in New York. Are we doing anything in that range in the frequency radio band to listen to other galaxies and stuff?
Well, TV is pretty low frequency for the kind of stuff that you do in astronomy or SETI. Just to give you an idea. I mean, you know, your AM radio is all below 1 megahertz. So if you listen to the stations, they'll tell you, you know, 560 kilohertz on the dial or something like that, right? So that's 560,000 cycles per second, whatever. That's all less than 1 megahertz. TV is more up at around 100 megahertz, maybe higher than that. Okay, but SETI and radio astronomy are usually up around thousands of megahertz. Okay, so that what's called a gigahertz. I mean, it's kind of technical, but I don't think that this explains your original question. Why Channel 1? You know, we got to take that 1 off the dial. It's like taking 13 off the elevator buttons. You know, there's no good reason for it. I used to know, and I don't know anymore, but I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that Channel 1 had magic properties, and if you had a station in Cedar Rapids that you could hear it, you know, in New York or Paris or anything like that. It was just a frequency that they, in the end, gave up for some other very practical reason. I don't think it was any different than Channel 2, 3, 4, or 5 in terms of its ability to propagate.
Seth, it's got to be fun for you to go into work and do what you do.
Well, I guess it is. I mean, I don't think of it that way when I'm fighting for a parking space, but yeah, I guess you're right.
I mean, where are you based?
Well, we're in the lovely, glamorous Mountain View, California, actually.
Okay.
That's the Silicon Valley, and in fact, we're about 2 miles from the Googleplex.
Are you in an office structure? Yeah. Are you underground in a bunker? Where are you?
I don't know. Being underground, maybe in earthquake territory, not a good idea. I don't know. But no, we're just in another Silicon Valley tilt-up. It's another office building, and we share that building with some high-tech firms that are doing you know, web-based stuff and things like that. Yeah.
When people eventually figure out what you're doing or they ask you, they've got to be wowed by it, huh?
Well,
like the signal.
Yeah, some are. I mean, there's a big, you know, sign on the door, SETI Institute and so forth, and the people who are working for the high-tech firms that we share the building with will occasionally ask us questions because they find it interesting. We, you know, sometimes around Christmas or Halloween, we'll have parties and we'll invite them in or they'll invite us in, and, you know, then they get the chance to talk and ask us about what we do. But again, keep in mind, most of the people at the SETI Institute are doing, astrobiology. And, you know, people are interested in that, but they don't know as much to ask about, you know, the history of water on Mars as they do about, well, have you found aliens? That's a slightly different subject for them. But, I think they're interested. They seem to be.
Larry is truck driving in Indiana, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good, Larry. Thank you.
My question is, if you got a verifiable signal, could you tell where its point of origin was and how long ago it was sent?
All right. If you found a viable signal, Seth, could you be able to pinpoint where exactly it was coming from?
Well, I think so. I think so. Larry, this is what you do. If you found a signal, and you'd have to check it out for a couple of days before you would convince yourself, but let's say you did that. Then at that point, you would, you know, get people at other radio observatories that have, for example, antennas that are spread over more of the landscape, bigger antennas, put it simply, and they would be able to sort of zero in on where the signal's coming from, all right? So they would be able to plot out a little box on the sky and say, it's in there somewhere, right? So then you would take these big, you know, ordinary telescopes, mirror and lens telescopes, so-called optical telescopes, and you would make very, you know, long exposure photos of that patch of sky and see if there are any stars there. And then if there weren't, I mean, that would be kind of interesting, but, you know, it's possible. And if there were, you would use other telescopes and try and find out, does it have any planets? Now, all this is going to take, you know, maybe months, but you can be sure that if we found a signal, every telescope in the world would be involved in trying to figure out more. They would all be looking at the same spot on the sky.
Seth, if a signal, in your opinion, was going to be successfully retrieved, any idea what would be the area that you would say, uh-huh, I knew it?
Oh, you mean, is there some
spot out there that even you would say, I knew it. It was there.
I mean, is there a better place for the aliens to sort of hang out?
Yeah, that's not a bad question.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, that's something that we certainly think about because, you know, you can't look at everything. So where are you going to point the antennas? And clearly, when something like Tabby Star comes along, you know, we'll spend some time looking at that because clearly that's an interesting thing. What we're spending a lot of time on now are the dimmer stars of the galaxy, so-called red dwarf stars. These are stars that are smaller than the sun and a lot dimmer than the sun. And you might say, well, you know, what's the advantage? The advantage is that these dim stars are known to have planets, quite a few planets, and they are also known to have planets that, you know, might have liquid oceans and atmospheres and all the things you need for a decent lifestyle. And there are lots of them. Three-quarters of all stars are these little guys. So, you know, there are a lot of them that are pretty close. And they're also, by the way, pretty old. And as I like to say, this is the one example I can think of where being older might be better. Because if they're older, they might have had more time to cook up some intelligent life. So that's what we're looking at, these dim stars.
Let's go to St. Louis. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Seth.
Hi there.
Hi.
Say, I noticed a rain. You know, if you take water, put it on a flat surface, it magnifies. So why can't you use the curvature of the Earth of a lake or the ocean as a convex lens for to use as a telescope? And I have a second question. I Love Lucy is 65 years old, so that signal is 65 light years out there. I understand you lose signal strength with the square of the distance. There would be very little signal left 65 light years out. Now, I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Okay, George. George in St. Louis. I mean, is this...
That's close.
Yes, that's your... Double gong.
And I just left there.
Yeah. Well, okay, George. Well, first off, you know, could we use the ocean as a big lens? Of course, that would be an optical telescope. But the fact that a drop of water on your desk, you know, looks like it's magnifying things is because it's small enough for it to assume almost a spherical shape, a hemispherical shape. And that works as a lens. It's not a very good lens, actually. You know, it's probably better than a Coke bottle, but it's not a very good lens. The real problem is how do you get underneath the ocean or the lake or whatever? You know, it doesn't have a very well-defined shape. It wouldn't be very good optics. Really, maybe that analogy is a good one. Forget your glasses. Just cut off the bottoms of some Coke bottles and use those as glasses. It might be cheaper, but it probably isn't very good. Second
question about dissipating signals.
Yeah, the signals do get weaker, of course, and as you say, they get weaker as the square of the distance. So, you know, they get weaker fairly quickly.
So the star systems closer would be able to send us stronger signals. Okay, welcome back. Our final segment with Seth Shostak from SETI. Seth, the title of your book, Confessions of an Alien Hunter. What are the confessions?
I've heard from readers that there weren't enough confessions.
Uh-huh.
Sounds like I owned up to something, you know.
Yeah.
But it was mostly a description. I think that the confessions part was mostly a description of people who call me who have, you know, claimed evidence of aliens on Earth, that kind of thing. But the rest is a description of, you know, the premise of SETI, why we think they're out there, how we're looking, and what it would mean if we found them, and maybe even something about what the aliens might be like, that kind of thing.
The other book, of course, was called Sharing the Universe, Perspectives on Extraterrestrial Life. I like that title.
Yeah.
They're out there. Then there may be many out there.
Oh, well, yes. No, I can tell you this. In astronomy, there are only three numbers for everything. Everything either comes in, either there's only one of them, or there are two of them, or there's an infinite number of them. So you can't just have, you know, a couple. So assuming that there are more than two societies out there, there are probably a very large number of them.
Do you get very spiritual when it comes to this?
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard to say what spiritual means to me, but I don't think so. I mean, it is true sometimes, you know, you can deal with numbers, you don't think about them very much, but sometimes you just, you know, just looking at the sky in a dark location, or even for that matter, just going to a planetarium show where they show you these models of the universe, you know, how these hundreds of billions of galaxies whirling around. And I don't know that it makes me spiritual, but it's pretty awesome in the sense of instilling awe, because you realize how incredibly vast it all is. And that does strike me sometimes, I have to say.
Well, the universe itself is awe-inspiring. I mean,
well, it
is amazing.
I guess the good news is that we happen to be living in a generation where you can understand some of it, too.
In your opinion, how did life start?
Well, my opinion is probably worthless on this. There are people who spend a lot of, they spend their careers trying to figure this out.
And they still haven't.
They still haven't. But the problem is that it's a very tough detective story, because the clues are, you know, very hard to find, because the way life started were just, you know, some molecules that were able to reproduce fairly accurately, just make copies of themselves. And once you have that, then, okay, you know, you begin to get Darwinian evolution, the ones that can reproduce a little faster, survive preferentially, and all that stuff. But this is all going on at, you know, a microscopic level with very soft materials that didn't last the 3.5 or 4 billion years that it's been since it happened. So, you know, where did it happen? The favorite theory these days is it probably happened in these very hot water vents at the bottoms of the oceans, right? These black smokers, they're sometimes called. But these places where, you know, because of the hot interior of the Earth, there's hot water coming up through cracks in the bottom of the ocean. And you get a lot of chemistry down there, and that's what's usually assumed to be where life got started. But we're not sure.
No, we're not sure. But it is amazing, isn't it? It is truly remarkable.
Yeah, you'd like to know how it got started, because that would give you some insight into whether it could have gotten started anywhere else.
Here we go. Let us go right to the calls now. Mike in Montana, welcome to the program. Michael, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Seth.
Hi, Mike.
I was wondering, a few months ago I heard about this new force of nature. I was wondering if you thought this might lead to dark energy discoveries.
Well, Mike, do you know what force it might be? I mean, I'm not sure.
Proton neutron, I guess, interaction instead of the normal. I don't know exactly all of the details, but it was some new force of nature possibly discovered not very long ago, maybe a couple months.
Well, Mike, I hate to beg off your question. I don't know. You know, they're generally recognized to be four forces in nature, right? Those are the ones we've known for quite a while, you know, gravity and electricity, if you will, electromagnetic force, and a strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. A new force would be a big deal. You know, there's one in Star Wars, but I don't know about that force. But these other four, I don't know, Mike. You stumped me. I don't know about this fifth force. But
a lot, are there things in the universe, other than, let's say, dark matter, that are so well known because they happen everywhere?
Well, dark matter seems to be everywhere, that's for sure. And in fact, it seems to be essential. If you didn't have dark matter, whatever it is, if you didn't have it, then maybe, you know, galaxies wouldn't have formed, and we wouldn't have big star systems, and maybe you might not even had, you know, the kind of conditions that would lead to us. That's a little less clear. But it's everywhere. I mean, that's one of the assumptions about people who study what's called cosmology, so sort of the structure of the whole universe, not just, you know, Mars or something, you know, very local and small, but study the whole thing. One of the assumptions you have to make, and it seems to be approximately true, is that it's the same everywhere. That if you were suddenly to push a button and you get transported to a galaxy a billion light years away, or for that matter, 10 billion light years away, you would look around, and yeah, the details would be different, but it wouldn't be all that different. It's basically the same everywhere.
Are other people listening and looking for signals from space other than us? Does anybody have a similar array of telescopes somewhere else?
When we say us, do you mean here in the U.S.?
Yes, here in, you know, are the Chinese doing this? Are the Russians doing this?
Yeah, well, that's actually a really good question, George, because, you know, in the past, the Soviet Union did a lot of SETI work. They did. And it was for a long time, it was the Soviets and the Americans. The Italians have done some. The Chinese have this new big radio telescope, the FAST telescope, F-A-S-T, which is, as I say, even bigger than the one down in Puerto Rico. It's big. It's big. And they say they want to do SETI with it. They haven't done it yet because they have to shake down the telescope for a while. But when you boil it all down, it turns out that it's mostly the Americans that have done this. And I've often wondered why that's the case. I think it has to do with the Americans' mentality, their culture, that they're willing to take a gamble.
Or the belief in extraterrestrial life, maybe.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I lived in Europe for a while, and the people there in the country I lived in, which was Holland, they certainly believed that there was, you know, there was life out there, and probably intelligent life. They just didn't think it was worth any money to try and look for it.
When I first talked to you, I was doing my local Nighthawk show in St. Louis, and you were at the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico.
I remember that.
I'm doing this local talk show. I had heard you on Coast to Coast with Art, and I said, I got to get that guy on my show. And, and we found you out there, and it was just so cool.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed doing those shows because I would be sitting in the control room there at Arecibo at night, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, the operators are sitting there listening to what I'm saying. They can't hear you, but they could.
How's that telescope functioning these days?
Well, it's a great instrument, I have to say. It's a great instrument. The problem is, as usual, money, because they have been funded typically, well, they've been funded by the National Science Foundation for a long time, so tax money, if you will. And it costs about $10 million a year to run that thing because it's, you know, it's big, it's in the jungle, you have to maintain it, and there's a lot of electronics and this, that, and the other. And the National Science Foundation has said, look, you know, we want to spend the money on newer telescopes, so you guys have to fund or find money to pay for a substantial fraction of the cost of running the thing. So it is under threat a bit, which would be a shame because it's a really very useful instrument.
It sure is. As old as it is, my gosh, what is it, 30 years old?
More than that. It was built in the early 60s. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Half century old.
Paul in Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Paul, you're on with Seth Shostak. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I'm glad you brought up that. I was just going to ask, you know, you disagreed with Stephen Hawking about that the aliens might be bad, but then I heard you talking later what they might be like. So if you're not really sure, I've always said that anything that would abduct me at 3 a.m. and give me an exam is not my friend. But anyway, I'd like to ask... If the aliens were to come down, let's say, and land on the White House lawn tomorrow, what would happen to SETI? I mean, what would you guys, still be following the stars, or what would you do? And I'll take my answer off the air. And thanks, George.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, well, Paul, I think if they landed on the White House lawn, I mean...
The day the Earth stood still.
Yeah, exactly. If Michael Rennie walked down the ramp... and
Or Gort...
Yes, Gort. You know, personally, I would be stunned and probably afraid, to be honest. If they come here like that, who knows? I mean, they're at home with us now, and it's one thing to talk about aliens that might be 10, 100 light years away. It's something else if they're on the White House lawn. But, yeah, I would be totally stunned. I don't know. I think SETI would go into a different line of work, probably.
We have Jake in Birmingham, Alabama, first-time caller for us. Hi, Jake. Go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Great.
It's an honor to be on your show.
Good to have you.
I have a question for a guest, and it has to do somewhat with galactic structure. When I was a kid, we went to a large planetarium, and they talked about our galaxy, and they call it our sister galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, and that we were both spiral-shaped galaxies, as if everything was laid out in a plate or disk and spinning around a central axis. They talked about a large orb of some kind that is some type of energy and emits light, but they said it was not a sun, and that they really weren't sure what it was, and they didn't have the technology at the time to measure across. And that is the only time I've ever heard about that in any books. And I was wondering, do you have the technology to where you can see that? And is that true that there is something at the center of, say, the Andromeda galaxy that is somewhat playing this, the role of a large sun of the galaxy in a spiral galaxy?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, Jake, but I'll tell you what I do know. Most galaxies, and certainly our galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy, which is kind of a sister galaxy, it's, I think, a little bit bigger than ours, but basically looks the same. If you had pictures of them taken from deep space, you put them up on your wall, you know, you might forget which was Andromeda, which was the Milky Way, our galaxy. But both of those galaxies, and many galaxies, actually, have big black holes at their centers, their very inner core. There's a big black hole. There's a big black hole in the center of our galaxy, which, you know, is formed from the mass of tens of millions of suns. Tens of millions of stars have given their all to make that black hole. I don't think they did it willingly, but, you know, that's who they are. And that's true in Andromeda, too. And if you want to see that black hole, it's actually quite hard. It's because, you know, there's so many stars near the center of a galaxy, that just sort of blinds you. Your telescope has a hard time seeing right down in there into that nest where the, where the black hole is. But there are techniques. You can use infrared telescopes and so forth, and you can find the big black hole in our own galaxy, and you can get some idea of the big black hole in other galaxies in some cases, either from radio waves or from infrared light.
What do you see as the biggest, greatest marvel of the universe?
Well, I think the existence of the universe, right?
Because, I agree with that.
You know, I think it occurs to everybody at some point. Why is there something rather than nothing? You know?
And how did something come from nothing?
Right, exactly. And physicists can say you can't have nothing because of various quantum mechanical effects, and you're always going to get something. But I've never found that very satisfying somehow.
I think my mom hit it on the head, Seth. She said, always was, always will be.
Yeah, well, of course, the Big Bang suggests that it wasn't always.
Uh-huh. But I don't believe in the Big Bang.
Well, you probably should change. I'll try and change your mind, George.
And I'll try to work on yours with the visitations of UFOs.
Okay.
Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I wanted to ask Seth, now, how often do you do upgrades on the signal receivers, your antennas? And is elevation that important? I mean, would it be more successful if you had a higher elevation to place your equipment at? And also, are there sounds that are off the sound spectrum that your equipment can analyze?
Yeah. Well, all right, before I forget all the questions, let me try, Joe. Upgrading the equipment, you do that, you know, the computers, the software, all that. Obviously, you can't change that every week. You change that over cycles of 5, 7, 10 years. Okay, so that's kind of that. In terms of would things be better if the whole thing were higher, the altitude where the Allen Telescope Array is located is it's about 3,200 feet, something like that. It's between 3 and 4,000 feet. It's closer to 3. All right, but making it higher wouldn't help terribly much because the radio waves come right through the atmosphere, at least at the frequencies that we observe at. So there's not a whole lot of advantage if you raise the whole observatory somehow, you know, another couple of thousand feet. That wouldn't help. That does help for telescopes that, you know, use mirrors and lenses, you know, optical telescopes that are using light, but not for radio. And I think your final question, what was your final question? It was... Tell me, Joe, what was my final question?
Are there sounds that
are
off the sound spectrum that ordinarily would escape, you know, this equipment's, maybe escape the equipment's ability to pick up that you know of?
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, again, we're not listening for sounds directly. We're looking for radio signals, which your radio receiver turns into sounds, but... we can only, you know, tune over so much of the radio dial because you have to build the receivers. They have to be very, very good receivers because you don't want receiver noise. You don't have to build such good receivers if you're just tuning into coast to coast because the transmitters are pretty powerful. But, you know, that's not the case for the Cosmos. So we typically, our receivers go from about 1 to 12 gigahertz. That's 1 to 12 billion cycles per second, and that's pretty high frequency. But you know, if the signal is coming in outside that range of frequencies, obviously we wouldn't detect it.
Seth, as we wrap things up here at the Coast to Coast, I want to thank you, and I will see you in Santa Clara at the Alien Con. I'm looking forward to the panel.
I am too, George. I think it's going to be lively.
Let's get together during that event too, okay?
Okay, you got it.
Seth Shostak. And those of you still on hold, maybe I'll keep you on hold for tomorrow's guest, and you can ask. You'll be the first ones to answer and ask them a question. No, I'm only kidding. But the great program tonight, I wanted to thank the folks from the Hollywood Ghost Hunters for spending some time with us. And, of course, always Seth Shostak. Even in the wee hours, he always makes himself available here. Mike Barra, who is going to be our guest tonight, is sick. And we had to postpone him, but he will be back to talk about his new work. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.